outside. Go. Psychology.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Dark Side of Psychology podcast. This episode is probably going to be titled something like Musings on Profiling a Serial Killer. Part one today is going to be with an interview with Dr. Oren Amate. Anyone who's listened to my podcast before is probably familiar with his name, but for those of you who are not, he is a clinical psychologist, is also a lecturer at Ryerson University since 2008. He's sought out on TV, radio, newspaper, and internet interviews approximately once or twice per week. I've actually heard him on the local news channels in Canada. Just as a side note, I'd like to say that these following episodes, these are very much musings. They're speculation and just intellectual curiosity from people talking to each other, trying to work things out as we go along. And you'll notice that during the interview, we really are batting ideas back and forth. This is not a well-polished, streamlined interview where information is just presented as it would be in a textbook. So please bear that in mind when you're listening. Mistakes are made, and sometimes we correct each other, and sometimes we agree. Okay, thanks very much, and enjoy the episode.
Yeah, I think many mass shooters, mass murderers, even serial killers, anyone who's taking the life of other people, often do meet or would meet the criteria for either an actual bona fide diagnostic and statistical manual for mental disorders, personality disorder. So that would be either narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, possibly paranoid personality disorder, occasionally borderline personality disorder, but I don't want people to, you know, borderline personality disorder is a whole other category, but these people can have those traits. But the first three that I mentioned, mostly narcissistic, antisocial, and maybe paranoid, but they could also more likely or equally likely be diagnosed with psychopathy or sociopathy, and those are not in the DSM, so we just have to distinguish the two. However, they are real constructs. There are people who are psychopaths or sociopaths, and the problem is that, A, people toss those words around way too much, so they almost lose their meaning. And B, people confuse those with psychotic. I can't count the number of people who say, oh, my boyfriend, he's so psychotic, he's an asshole or something. And that's not psychotic, right? Because we need to have empathy and compassion and tolerance for someone who is psychotic. And psychotic is simply, of course, as you know, someone who's lost touch with reality. And that can happen through, for example, schizophrenia. Or it can happen through maybe people are not going to have sympathy for this, but it could be drug use. They can have a psychotic disorder. They can have a psychotic episode. 20% of people who are severely depressed could experience psychosis at some point, so they can have a break from reality. So when we're talking to someone like that, their actions are not their own. They are not in control of their actions, and we have to understand that, and therefore our reactions to them have to be very different from somebody who's a psychopath who knows exactly what they're doing. They do know right from wrong, which is someone who's psychotic does not. They know exactly that they're doing bad things and sometimes evil things, and they just don't give a damn, and they have to be held 100% accountable. So people have to distinguish between them, because I've done many interviews where somebody who did have a psychosis, they were locked up and now they're trying to be released, and people say we should never release them. They didn't do their time. And it's like, you're basically punishing them for something they had no control over. And if that person was a good person, quote unquote, if they feel remorse, if they're taking their medication, and if we can show that really it was the psychotic episode that led them to do it, then we need to, again, have that that compassion. But these mass murderers are not usually of that type. And people say, well, how could someone, quote unquote, normal do this kind of thing? Doesn't it take a sick mind or a psychotic mind? No, it just takes evil. It just takes a complete lack of empathy. And that's what people have to understand. If you are psychopathic, if you are a sociopath, then you have zero empathy. You have no remorse. You have no regard for others. And so that means you could literally do anything without, you know, concern. And that is what a person who goes on a mass shooting, for example, is doing. And people have to understand that. And, you know, look, we fluctuate in our empathy. You might not be very empathetic. It exists on a spectrum usually. So the less empathy you have, the more capacity for doing bad things you have. It doesn't mean you're going to go out and kill people. More likely, you're going to go out and, you know, you're going to join a company that has very, let's say, dubious or illegal practices that is going to screw people over, ruin their lives and everything. And you're going to make lots of money off of it. And all you're looking at is your paycheck versus the life that you've ruined. That's what somebody with a lack of empathy can do. And that's far more common than going out and shooting people.
Do you feel then that the majority of these mass shooters would probably fit that bill?
You know, I believe so when it comes to mass shooters. Now, the question is, were they born that way? Were they raised in a terrible environment that made them into this type of person? Or did they experience something later on in life where they were kind of pushed into this place where they lost all regard for others? So somebody who's abused as a child, for example, severely abused, they are more likely to be either, you know, sociopathic. Some people, Google difference between psychopathic and sociopathic, and you'll get a whole bunch of pages, and they claim that sociopaths are like this and psychopaths are like that. And I don't give much credence to those because, in many cases, what they describe a psychopath as, those traits are also shared by sociopaths and vice versa. So people shouldn't care too much about that. One person, I forget which, I don't think it was Hare, Robert Hare, I think it was someone else who said that they distinguish psychopaths and sociopaths from, or they distinguish between the two by saying that psychopaths are born that way. Mm. So, you know, and sociopaths are made that way. So, but how do we know that? Because research has shown that, and we can do these experiments on monkeys or other animals, can't do them on humans. So if you deprive a chimpanzee from birth of its maternal affection, and then you cut its brain open a little while later, they show that the dysfunction in the frontal lobe is very similar to what we see with psychopaths. So that weren't born that way. They were randomly assigned, sadly, to be deprived of any maternal affection. And so it did make them susceptible to acting like a psychopath. And they do behave that way. They're very aggressive. They have no empathy. So who's to say that the child was born that way, or from the very first day they were deprived of a healthy upbringing and that made them that way? So I don't think people should get caught up on that. What I think they should look at is, what is this person's functioning? Do they operate without any regard for the impact on other people? And I would say that most of these mass shooters definitely can be described in that way. And again, is it from birth? Is it from a young age? Or was it later in life where they were pushed to the point that they said, you know, screw it, I don't care, I've been hurt, now it's my turn to hurt others. And, you know, we see many times people do this not to strangers in a mass shooting, but we see it to them doing it to their own children, you know, infanticide, killing kids, whether it's through drowning them, through poisoning them, through shooting them. You know, we see these things and you think, how could someone be pushed to that degree? Or how could someone be such a monster that they could do that to their own child? So the point is that if we use the criterion of what is their capacity for empathy, for compassion, for remorse, for concern for other well-being, and for basically for being able to take someone else's perspective, most of these people would fit into that category if they don't have all of that, which would, you know, again, classify them pretty much as a psychopath or sociopath.
It's interesting because it's almost, if you're looking at it from the developmental perspective, I agree with you, by the way, that distinction between psychopath and sociopath is not a good one, because in the literature it's just not well understood and people seem to use them interchangeably, et cetera, et cetera. So if I just call it acquired sociopathy for now, if we're talking about from a developmental perspective, someone has a horrific upbringing or some kind of serious traumatic events periodically in their lives, and it, I suppose, almost breaks them so that they no longer feel or care about the emotional well-being of others. Do you feel that in this case with mass shooters, if we're getting someone who is in a lot of pain themselves, doesn't know how to deal with that pain, and wishes pain upon others in terms of a revenge, would that be like it's almost like it's emulating the traits of psychopathy without necessarily being psychopathic, if you understand my meaning?
Right. Yeah, it's almost what Anna Freud would call, in a way, it's used slightly differently, but I would broaden it to identifying with the aggressor. Mm. So they're basically, they've learned to deal with their pain by emulating, as you say, not necessarily, being a psychopath, but you have to think the kind of person who hurt them, historically, would have had no empathy or compassion for them, so they've kind of identified with that role, and now they're saying, it's my turn. But unfortunately, they're not taking out all that hurt and pain and anger and hatred on the person who hurt them, but on another innocent victim, just like they were, right? So yes, they could be somebody who would not have any of those underlying psychopathic traits that you would normally see in a real psychopath, sociopath, whatever. Like, for example, harming animals when they were younger, having... Right. Look, I mean, I've seen children who we would probably think of as potential psychopaths, and the glassy look in their eyes, just that lack, it's like looking at a frog's eyes, basically, where it just, there's no connection whatsoever. So, I think that people who don't have that, people who do look like just a normal, healthy, happy kid, could develop or be pushed to the point where they would then act out just like, indistinguishable from a psychopath, but not be that type of person, no doubt. And this is where sometimes mental illness can come in, where somebody, for example, could have such severe depression. Now, this is going to sound, to me, this is quite different, and maybe we're verging on being psychotic, not psychopathic, but if somebody, let's say, is severely depressed, they've lost all hope, they have no sense of future, like there's just, they see nothing for themselves, and then they somehow hang that despair on somebody else and say, you are the cause of my suffering. And they act the way that they would never do in another situation. Is that possible that they are within, they have their faculties intact, they know what they're doing, they know what's right from wrong, but they kind of go not into a dissociative state where they would also not be responsible. They're totally responsible for their actions, but they experience an extreme shift in their personality or in their capacity for empathy. Can they undergo that? I do believe it's true. I do believe people can do that. And so in a case like that, here's where we have to be very careful. Here's where you and I, and we would hope any other reasonable, intelligent, and let's say any person who's looking for truth with a capital T, I think can have a nuanced discussion about this. So what I just described about someone being depressed, if they're so depressed and they reach that, they're one of those 20% of the people who do have a psychotic episode and they kill someone. Mothers with postpartum depression, for example, could fit into that category where, the hormones shifted, they're in a depression, and they do become psychotic, and they kill their child. A person like that would deserve all our compassion and empathy, versus somebody who's in this despair, and, right or wrong, they blame somebody for being in that situation. I'm going to give you one very specific example in a second, and they do something horrific, whether it's against that person, or against that person's child, or against society in general. Well, in the latter case, I don't care how much despair you're in. If you are in control of your mind and you know right from wrong, I can feel sad that you've gone through all this, but that will not excuse you in any way. And that's where I think we really need people to be able to understand that when we have these kinds of discussions, it's not justifying somebody's actions, it's explaining it. So if someone's psychotic and has no control over their actions, then they deserve leniency. If they do have control, then no, they get the full force of the law.
So you're going to give an example, were you?
Yes, so here's the example, and I fight for these people, I fight to help them so they don't reach this state. So what I'm about to say will sound cold maybe, but I want people to understand that I've helped many people in this situation, and I've seen how people can just lose all sense of hope. And again, I'm not justifying the horrific outcomes, but I am damn clear in understanding how someone could reach this state. And it's often fathers, it's somebody who's being dragged through divorce court, and has, and again, I've worked with many men who've gone through this, and they go through a system, and I'm not going to paint every case with the same brush, because many men, or some men who claim that they were, you know, given a raw deal, that it was unfair, that the cards were stacked against them, people lied. In many of those cases, they themselves are lying. But I have seen enough cases where, truly, they were accused of the most horrific things, sexually abusing their child. They had a partner who made their lives miserable. They had a partner who basically drained their bank accounts, whether through their own spending or through the lawyers, and made them have to go through years and years of not seeing their children, of having their reputation torn to shreds, of being in a court system and believing, wait a second, this is a place of justice, and I'm getting zero justice. And just, you know, watching a lawyer that they spent $500,000 on not doing their job, or not, you know, fighting to show this person's lying through their teeth, or having professionals misdiagnose or misassess them. So when you see everything you believed in your whole life, thinking that if I'm a good person and I do my best to, you know, to help others or to conduct myself as expected, and all of that means absolutely nothing. Not only am I not being rewarded for it, but I'm being punished in the most severe way. I could see someone like that snapping and then doing the most horrific things. And sadly, some of them, you know, they will, this is, again, we have to be careful here, because some of them will kill their own child purely to get revenge on their partner. Now, if you're in control of your, you know, your mental faculties, and you do that as revenge, I'm sorry that you got pushed there, but damn it, you're evil. To kill a child to, you know, to get revenge on that kid's mother. In other cases, they get pushed to the point of, and I do believe it is psychosis, whether it's a man or a woman, where they believe that the other person is just so dangerous that I'm protecting the child, you know, ending their life here. Maybe they're religious, maybe they believe they're sending them to heaven, who knows how they rationalize it, but ending their life now is far better than the hell that they are going to live through with, you know, this other parent, because I'm being cut out of the picture and I'm not able to protect them. And that can be a personality disorder. That's, if it's a woman, it's often borderline personality disorder. Not always, but it can be. Like I said, it can be the psychosis, or it can just be that their life's turned upside down and they're trying to rationalize their horrible actions. So that does happen. And again, this is not mass murder, it's not mass shooting, but the fact is, those kinds of cases are far more common than mass shootings or mass murder. And I want people to understand that. You and I were talking before we began with helping people understand that even if they're committing evil, they are part of our species. We may not think of them as human, but they are. And I'm not saying that so that we can feel pity for them. I'm saying that so that we can understand that humans are capable of doing some terrible things. And when you have the right combination of personality with history, with current circumstances, maybe with drugs or alcohol, maybe with antidepressant medication or other medications that might be acting on our brain the way that we don't know, with access to weapons or with motive and everything, you put all those factors together and you can see how monsters can be created. And that's, you know, the fact that there are some monsters who are born that way. There are some true hardcore psychopaths that they're just evil from the day that they hit the planet. But others are created that way. And again, if we understand it the way that we're talking about it this way, we can see how, quote-unquote, ordinary people could be pushed pretty far. We hope they don't cross that line into evil, but they can get pretty damn close.
I think you made an interesting distinction, which I'm wrestling with and I'm trying to understand it. This idea of when someone has met that threshold for psychosis and when they're just conducting an evil act. I think that's a really hard one from the perspective of when someone is willing to justify their end result in their head or otherwise. How do you make a decision whereby you can confidently say this person is functioning cognitively, but they've got to a point now where they're going to commit horrific acts, but they know exactly what they're doing, versus, well, this person clearly is not thinking or in a well state of being, and you cannot really hold them accountable for their sins because of psychosis. And maybe if I make it less abstract, it might be useful. Let's say if you take a father who's as you described, being raked over the coals like that through divorce courts, and they lose absolutely everything. They lose their children. There's nothing left for them. Everything is really bad, and they go, well, you know, the mum is evil, so I'm going to kill the mum. She's the one that's put me through this misery. At what point do you say to yourself, well, he's either thinking and he's fine, but he's just plotting revenge, or you think, well, no, he's completely lost the plot and he's in an element of psychosis?
Well, I would say, or somewhere in between, where they have lost everything and they're plotting revenge, but they're convincing themselves, right, that somehow they're doing right by their child. Because that's that other category, as I mentioned earlier. Well, even in one of those cases, again, whether it's just pure outright revenge, they're just, you know, plotting evil, or they're doing it and they're trying to convince themselves that they are doing right by their child. Those two, to me, can be lumped together because the person knows right from wrong. They're just rationalizing their actions. How do you know the difference? Well, if it's the case that other people are there, usually when a person's in a state of psychosis, you can tell. We had a famous case in Canada, or an infamous case. The name was Vincent Lee. He's changed his name now. He was called the Greyhound Bus Killer. Mm-hmm. It was, I want to say, Manitoba. I'm very Toronto-centric, so anything west of downtown. So in his case, there were witnesses, and there's no doubt that he had lost his mind. He was in a state of psychosis. So that is pretty clear to tell. Now, if somebody, there's no witnesses when they did their horrific act, and then you catch them weeks later when the psychosis could, in theory, have abated, then the question is, in talking with them, seeing how they frame it, if they say things like, you know, she's evil, she robbed me of my livelihood, she's a terrible person, she did this and that, well, I'm thinking they're not psychotic. Saying that she's evil doesn't mean it. But if the person is talking in a way where you just see that they're really not connected to me right now, the words are coming out, the sentence structure is intact, there is syntax, but they're, you know, they have a thought disorder here, things are just not really connecting together. Now, can people act that way? Son of Sam tried to say that. He said, my dog told me to kill these people, and, you know, other people have tried to say things like that. And a trained psychiatrist or psychologist who has worked with people in these different states, they, we would hope, would be able to discern, let's say, psychosis from acting or from despair. And they don't always get it right. You know, I think the most, here's a tricky one. Let's get really controversial. Hey, it's your podcast, so you can take all, I'm just the messenger.
Go on then.
Send your emails to, all right, so here we go. Here's where I think we're going to find the most, how can I say this, not based on science, not based on clinical experience, but based on ideology. And these are real cases. And when you hear people talk about it, it really is ideology. And I think everybody today can relate to this because it's something that's happening in the media today, but in a less extreme case. And I'm talking about a woman who murders her husband and then claims, you know, abused wife syndrome. Now, I have worked with many, many women and men and children who have been abused. And I have no doubt, I can't prove this, and I've got some colleagues who disagree with me, but I, based on what I've seen, based on what I know of the human condition, I am prepared to say that in some cases, somebody who has suffered lots and lots of abuse from, let's say a husband, just make it simple, but it can go the other way around. People have to understand that a woman can torture a man just the same way, but statistically speaking, it's more likely that this man would do the violent acts, the extreme violent acts. Okay, and just, I want to cover all my bases. I do know that in Canada, at least 40-50% of victims of domestic violence are men. So I'm not saying that it's always men hurting women, but I'm saying in a case where where a partner is severely abusing somebody, threatening death frequently, and or killing them, we know that men are more likely to do that to women than vice versa. I'm just talking statistics. This is not an ideological statement. So having said all that, I am willing to believe that a woman who has been abused for this long, who's suffering probably from post-traumatic stress disorder, I think that she can at some point get into a dissociative state. Maybe she, you know, he's hurt her so many times, and either it's right during the attack or shortly afterwards, or maybe a few days later, where suddenly it just, you know, she dissociates. She's not in control of her actions. And I do believe that she could, you know, then kill him. And in some cases, they say, wait a second, she shot him in his sleep. Or she stabbed him, you know, when his back was turned. So are you saying she wasn't defending herself then? So how can you say something like that? Well, that would be that she was in a, again, dissociative state. So she wasn't present. She was physically present, but mentally she wasn't. She was in a different state. And, you know, in that case, could she tell right from wrong? I don't think so. So that's very controversial, because now we are seeing people who are claiming in all cases that must be. And we cannot question, and we cannot say that, you know, a woman would ever lie about that, or lie about the fact that she was abused, or the manner, or the severity of it. And that's where, this is where I'm seeing everyone can relate now, because we see this with the Me Too movement, where, you know, nobody can deny, unless they're psychotic themselves, nobody can deny that, yes, many women have been harassed, abused, violated, etc. But to say that no woman would ever lie about it, or no woman would exaggerate or distort it, whether intentionally or unintentionally, that's ridiculous. So when it comes to women who have been abused and so on, can we say in every single case where a woman does kill her abuser or alleged abuser that she was in a dissociative state? I would be very scared to say that. And unfortunately, when I look at the literature, we are seeing cases where they are being treated that way. And we can't do that. We need to take it on a case-by-case basis. And if we find that the evidence does not support it, if we see that, you know what, nah, she looks pretty much in control of her actions. The cops came 5 minutes later and, you know, and she was completely competent and everything like that. You know, could she have snapped in that moment, right then and there, and then got back into normality? Maybe. But here's where we need to take an objective look, as objective, quote unquote, as possible. And I am not a forensic psychologist, so I haven't had enough experience where I could say, yep, 5 minutes later, I can see her, you know, snapping back into reality. Now, I've seen people dissociate in my office. I've seen them come back and everything like that. So I say it can happen, but who knows what the heck is going on? I've spoken to my patients after they've dissociated and tried to gain an understanding of it. And they're trying to put words to an experience that is almost impossible to understand. That's like, here's what other people can relate to. Try taking some DMT or ayahuasca or LSD, lots of it, and try to explain your experience. Good luck with that. You know, whatever words you try to put there, these are words, but do they really capture it? So how do we know that that person truly was dissociated? Sorry, how do we know that maybe they were in a state of heightened anxiety or fear or whatever else, and they did lash out and they did do something horrific, and maybe they were in control. Maybe they felt like they weren't, quote unquote, in control, but maybe they were. So this is where we have to be very careful, and we can't just assume, well, she said she was abused. Women don't lie about that. Because women do lie about that, as do men, as do others. So that was a long, long way of saying that, but these are just a few of the factors that we really need to consider when we talk about this. And however we look at this, we cannot bring ideology into it. And sadly, ideology does get dragged into it, whether it's in the field of psychology, psychiatry, forensics, the courts, criminal system, policing, all this stuff. I mean, there's a lot of overlap with everything I'm saying, but the point is, none of these fields is immune from ideology permeating and you know, taking over. So that's what we have to be careful about.
Yeah, and I would in a minute try and discuss some of that ideology that I've seen in a couple of articles recently. But I just wanted to, I'm trying to get my head around this with you now. I'm going to go over a few points and see if we can clarify them, if that's all right.
Sure, of course.
So if I take it back to the mass shooters, just take a typical example of a mass shooter, between 17 and 22-year-old adolescent or male, who's either being heavily bullied, really abusive family background, whatever the case may be, they're obviously in a lot of pain and distress, and they've become obsessed with revenge fantasy, revenge suicide fantasy. Now, as I see it, based on what we just discussed, there's a few options, but all of them lead to the same place of mental health issues. So let's just say the first one, really clear-cut one, the personality disorder. Let's just say that they were born this way, some bad things happen in their life, and they have absolutely no qualms of hurting other people to make amends in their head. That's a nice clear-cut one. We can clarify that. We can say, yep, they probably meet the DSM diagnosis or criteria for this, and, you know, outside the DSM for psychopathy. Okay. And then let's go to the acquired sociopathy route, where they were born, you know, quote, normal, but through some horrible things that have happened in their lives, they've just kind of lost that ability to have that emotional capacity, and now, of course, they're obsessed with pain, their pain and other people's pain. We could be starting to look, as you said, at that point, aren't they suffering from some kind of extreme cognitive distortion where they're just not seeing the world properly anymore? They've completely lost perspective of themselves and others. So that would be the first point, is if it's not biological personality disorder and it's not a thought disorder through a horrible upbringing, if it's then either a dissociative state or they've reached a point of psychosis because, you know, they snapped, something happened, even if they're suffering from PTSD, they're no longer in charge of their faculties, and like you said, they're not seeing right from wrong anymore. All of those conclusions, aren't they all a mental health issue, regardless of how you look at them? Isn't every single one of those conclusions, this person is suffering from some kind of mental health problems?
Good question. Yes. Depends on how you define a mental health problem. So
this is what I don't understand. I can't get my head around this 4-5% statistic, because at the very worst, at the very best, there's no way you can tell me that someone who goes and does this is not clinically depressed. Just as a basic baseline. No one would do this unless they were incredibly depressed about something going on in their lives. Would you agree with me there or not?
It depends. It depends. If it's a mass shooter who knows that they're going to be taken out, mm-hmm. then I think the depression could play a part. But if it's a serial killer, if it's a murderer who thinks that, you know what, I might actually get away with it, then it may not necessarily be depression. It can be rage. And here's the thing, let's tie this together. And this kind of goes back to the personality. Were you born this way? Were you raised this way? Who knows? But when you have narcissism, and there's several dozen different subtypes of narcissism. So when I say narcissism, I'm talking about the most evil kind, the worst kind, the malignant narcissist, or the kind of narcissist that I say, they're kind of on the same trajectory as psychopaths, just not as bad, but they're bad. Here's the thing that people have to understand, and this is very important, because I don't consider this to be a mental health issue. I consider it to be a perspective issue, and that's literally the fact that narcissists do not, and again, I'm talking the worst type, do not take other people's perspectives. And they don't take any perspective other than their momentary, you know, this is my life right now perspective. So even though some of them, you say, wait a second, they went into a place where they shot it up, there were cameras around, or maybe there were security guards, they had to have known that they were going to be killed. Well, someone who's so narcissistic and so wrapped up in their own fantasy life, they don't necessarily put two and two together. This is why they can lie so blatantly, and I'm not going to start diagnosing people, but let's just say in recent history, there are certain people who have made the most outrageous lies that are so easily disprovable, and people say, are they stupid? Are they crazy? Do they think that we're all stupid? And I used to, you know, before I became a psychologist, I would have thought the same thing, and then I realized, no. They're just a narcissist, and they're wrapped up in their own perspective, and they don't even think to see their own words or actions from another person's vantage point or another person's perspective, so they don't think about how ridiculous they look. They have no idea. So that kind of person, you know, who not only doesn't take other people's perspective, but they are also susceptible to narcissistic rage. So people with narcissism, they can experience that narcissistic rage through what we call narcissistic insult. So it's something so benign, something so minor that anyone else would brush off. But to them, you intentionally tried to hurt me. Now I've got to destroy you in some way. And that's for something minor. So imagine that same person has been subjected to some terrible stuff. Imagine what they're capable of doing. So what I call that, saying that, you know, that they're necessarily in depression and are on a death wish, not necessarily.
I guess from, so if we try and narrow the scope to just mass shooters, just because otherwise it'd be impossible, but this is, I think that'd even hold weight with the mass shooters, is what happens if that person does meet criteria for narcissistic personality disorder, and yeah, some bad things happen to them, and yeah, their option is always in their mind is, I need to destroy these people that have in some way slighted me, because it's like a very personal attack, it physically hurts them, in the word, that's how they feel it anyway. So that's interesting though, because then what we're suggesting is a diagnosable thing in a DSM does not to you equals mental health issue.
Well, it can still be, again, when it comes to personality, certain personalities, I would say, that are mental health issues. For me, for example, borderline personality is a severe mental health issue. Someone with schizoid personality or schizotypal personality, maybe even obsessive compulsive personality, which is not the same as obsessive compulsive disorder, but these, I think, can qualify as a mental health issue. But I have a hard time, and maybe it's my bias, but I have a hard time when someone's proclivity is, or they have a proclivity to harming people, to kind of lump that with these other disorders or these other conditions. I don't know, it doesn't feel right to me. So that's why I have a hard time. So, you know, even if it's technically a mental health issue, what I'm saying is I don't think that in any way should be considered as a mitigating factor. It might, again, sure. It's an explanatory factor, not mitigating. But let's say let's just take a look at bona fide mental health issues, because Oscar Pistorius tried this route. So when he killed his girlfriend or his fiance, he claimed anxiety. Now, anxiety, you know, I've worked with many people with anxiety. Anxiety can make you act in ways you don't want to act. It can completely flood your brain with nonsense and confusion and panic and so on. So I can see people doing things that they wouldn't want to do and wouldn't be in their character, etc. But if someone had a lot of anxiety and then they ended up taking steps that had such a huge impact on someone's life, and again, it's taking steps, it's not that they acted in a moment. Like if someone's driving, let's put it this way, someone's driving a car and suddenly they have a panic attack and they lose control and they kill three people, and we can show that they actually had a panic attack. Someone's recording them or like whatever, but we know they had a panic attack. They were not in their right state of mind. If, however, someone's at a bank and someone, you know, they suddenly have a anxiety attack and they suddenly think, oh my God, I'm going to die broke. And so they rob the bank right then and there. They threaten somebody like that. To me, there's a big difference, right? There has to be one step in between the mental health issue and their acting on that, or just their acting out. There was a moment, there was a thought of, I know what I'm doing. It may not be rational, but I know what I'm doing. So, you know, so even with mental health issues, I don't say that it gives us free ride to do things. In some cases it does, in some cases it doesn't. So again, I'm using the same condition, a panic attack or anxiety attack, and in one case where they just lose control and they kill somebody with a car accident, that's very different than they make a deliberate decision to do something that might have been fueled by anxiety, but they were still in control. So, you know, however we frame it, we need nuance. We can't just have one blanket response for everything.
It sounds almost like we're also saying that if someone is cool and calculated, or when they're planning whatever it is they're going to do, in this case, a mass shooting, versus someone who in a moment has lost control and doesn't quite know what the hell they're doing anymore, or has completely lost perspective, would that be a distinction for you as a between the mental health component and the darker side of people's personality type?
I can see some cases where somebody could have, let's say, schizophrenia. In some cases with schizophrenia, like with the Greyhound bus killer, no doubt he was not in control of his mind. But if someone has schizophrenia and they have delusions, or they have a delusional disorder, so for people who don't know, a delusion is a false belief. So that cannot be changed. No matter what you tell them, they will still hold on to their false beliefs. And I've worked with a number of people with them, and it's intractable. It just will not change. So somebody could be cold and calculated and look like they know what they're doing and plotting to, let's say, kill their neighbor who they believe is plotting to kill them, because that's their delusion. in a case like that, they still are not in control of their mind. Now, in this case, they might know right from wrong, like they might understand right from wrong, but they do not know that what they're doing is not wrong because they believe this person, let's say, is the embodiment of evil. So they might not be running around the streets naked and screaming and talking to themselves. They might look normal, quote unquote. And this is one thing, I don't want to scare everybody, but here's the reality. If you look at the DSM, the criterion, one of the criteria for delusional disorder is, unless they're actually talking about their delusion, they look perfectly fine. Okay? So there, that person, they're totally in control of their actions, but they're not in control of their mind. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, yes, I'm familiar with this as well, and it is scary the first time you come to that realization, but it's not always immediately obvious.
Right. Oh, for sure. Geez, yeah. Especially in today's day and age, because a lot of people's delusions are paranoid, so they think people are observing them, or you know, they've got people following them, and
yeah. It makes it very complicated in order to look at what's going on with these individuals who go ahead and go on these killing sprees in the context of personality type or mental health disorder, because with this whole 4-5% of them suffering from mental health illness, by that, are people suggesting that they don't meet a DSM diagnosis criteria?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I mean, technically, that's what it should be, that we should have the diagnosis through the DSM or the ICD-10. But that number seems so low. I agree. Sorry, you were going to say?
I was going to say, no, and it makes me wonder how much that number is based on the reality of the situation versus they're desperately trying not to stigmatize mental health, because obviously it's true, most people who are suffering from a garden variety mental health issue are much more likely to hurt themselves than other people. So I can definitely see where they're coming from in that perspective, but I do wonder if it is a little bit motivated by ideology in that way.
It's very possible. And, you know, if someone, especially these mass shooters, let's think of it this way. And I can, by the way, I can easily see why that number would be low, and I'll give an example. So with the mass shooter, if they're shot and killed, then there's, like, we can't clearly state what their, you know, state of mind was at the time, unless they were talking to somebody right before they were recorded or something like that. So we could easily say that they did not get help for their mental health issue. So they could have been depressed or had some, you know, some other condition. And just because they never got an official diagnosis, that's why they got the 4-5%. That would be the easiest way.
That makes sense. I think, because that number has really thrown me. And, because the debate is often around this, because they're going to start looking at laws now and policies in America about how to screen people more effectively, and you know, I think they're going to have a tough time agreeing on what that even means. I mean, like you were saying, let's just say some of these individuals are suffering from some kind of narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder or psychopathy or acquired psychopathy, whatever. That's one thing, and potentially that's a lot easier to screen for, diagnose, and then what we're going to do, stop anyone from who we feel gets to that threshold from having a gun. I suppose we could do that with narcissistic personality disorder as well. But then what happens when we're looking at people who are simply so in so much pain and depressed, and they've become obsessed with the revenge fantasy? How do we even screen for that, and how do we not admit honestly that there's some kind of mental health issue going on there?
Right, and that's a tricky thing. That's why I'm glad I'm not a policymaker, because, you know, do you err on the side of protecting people? Well, if you want to do that, then guess what? Nobody gets a gun. You can't destroy all guns. Or do you err on the side of personal freedoms? And if you do that, then there will be the risk of many people falling through the cracks. And no system is perfect. And here's the thing. This is why I get concerned, and you know, I'm glad to have this opportunity, because you know, you and I might know this, but other people may not. So people say, okay, give everyone a psychiatric evaluation. Well, I don't know how it is in other countries, but in Canada, usually a psychiatric evaluation, I've read a lot of these reports, it's a psychiatrist meeting the person for, you know, an hour or so. They talk, they ask them a few questions, and it's all self-report, and they might even give them a pen and paper test where they'll end, you know, it could be MMCI, MCMI, MMPI, or even just like a very basic, simple one. And it's all self-report. So if someone's a narcissist or a psychopath and they have any social savvy, which psychopaths do, it would be very easy to fool a psychiatrist in that regard. So the only way to really get them is to do really comprehensive testing. And even among psychologists, at least in Canada, I know that the type of testing that I do, I have so much faith in it because I've seen how accurate it is. I've seen how I've been able to capture, you know, over 1,000 people with these tests and how it's, you know, coincides with the reality that's documented elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera. So I believe these types of tests that I use called projective testing, I believe that they can really get to the heart of who a person is, along with other tests as well. You need a whole battery. But even my colleagues don't agree. Some of them say, well, should we really do this? It should all be self-report. And, you know, so even if you go my route, where we do all this comprehensive testing, 3 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, write up a report and so on, you know, it's going to price it out of the price range of so many people. So now we've restricted their personal freedoms and the wait lists now. And I'm not trying to make business for myself. I'm busy enough. I can see some psychologists or others say, yeah, you know, feed them to me. Let me assess them all. And so it's not even feasible. If you count, at least in the States, where I forget what percentage of people have guns. I forget the actual number. So is every single one of them going to go through a thorough, full-on psychological assessment to try to determine? Because even then, even if we find out that they're a narcissist, like, again, if they're a psychopath, I'm worried. If they're a narcissist, it doesn't mean for certain that they don't have empathy, because then on top of that, you have to do a risk assessment. It's a totally different type of assessment, or you can just add it on, and even those aren't perfect. So is it feasible? I don't think so.
I don't think it is at all, because, you know, even like if we're doing like a quite standard battery of assessments for, let's say, autism spectrum disorder, that can cost, in Australia, it can cost over $1,000 of any psychologist's time, probably close to $2,000 if you've got a more experienced psych doing it. So I can't even imagine, if we're talking about the kind of tests we would need, how comprehensive it would have to be and the experience required of the clinician. You know, yeah, we're going to be talking in a range of $3,000 to $4,000 per test because of all the time it takes to write them up and everything like this. How many people are going to be able to afford that?
Exactly. And then the time. Now, I'm a fan of not rushing to allow people to acquire these deadly guns. So I don't know if that's a good argument, but, you know, when it comes to, for example, just to give people some perspective, parenting capacity assessments. Now, here's the thing. If this was to be the case, if we were going to get psychologists to do these proper assessments, well, now we're getting into forensics. And in order to be a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist, you need to go into that area, that specialized area. And there aren't that many who do that. And if you're not, if you just say, well, I'm a psychologist, I can do testing, and I might not be able to do risk assessments, but I can see whether they have, you know, certain disorders, well, you've got to be prepared to go to court. You've got to be prepared to defend your report. And because I guarantee you, if someone is denied a gun, they're going to say no, right? So many psychologists are afraid of doing that. So now you've narrowed the field down even further. And it's going to become a litigation nightmare. And so, you know, people really have to consider all these factors. There's no easy, I mean, the bottom line is there's no easy solution to any of this. And you and I are looking at this from a psychological perspective. And as we alluded to earlier, when it comes to looking at things from a psychological perspective, I wish it were based on mostly facts, science, best practices, and evidence. But in reality, it won't be. It's going to be, there's going to be a lot of ideology involved. And so psychologists, can you imagine psychologists who are anti-gun? Do you want to, and are they going to declare that? No, they're not going to declare it. And whether they're overly aware of it or whether subconsciously anti-gun, are they going to give you a fair assessment? So, right. And so again, I don't want people to take from this looking at, okay, well, it's not possible to do assessments. That's not the point of this. That's just a symptom of the greater issue that you and I are discussing, which is whenever we look at any of these controversial issues, whether it's, you know, again, battered wife syndrome, whether it's access to weapons, whether it's who should, does he get the death penalty for a serial killing or for mass shooting and so on? Any of this, we need to take the same approach, which is nuanced, it's reasoned, and again, it's based on evidence and science and not ideology.
You know, the one thing that occurs to me as well of what you're just saying is with risk assessment is I would be quite skeptical of that, just because a lot of people who are risk are mostly a risk to themselves. I don't even know how good the predictive factors would be in terms of being able to outline if someone would be a risk to society if they had a handgun. If we're taking an example of narcissistic personality disorder, I'm assuming the vast majority of people with narcissistic personality disorder don't go out and kill other people with guns. And as you said, there's very many variants of narcissism, so some of them are more prone to suicide or self-inflicted pain than others. But and just trying to understand risk factor for anyone, even if we're saying, oh, okay, look, let's just say you have severe depression and the chance of you hurting someone else goes up slightly, especially if you enter psychosis or you're in a lot of pain. You know, the problem with the stigma there, which I can see, is a lot of people with depression aren't obviously going to hurt other people. They're more likely to hurt themselves. So we're talking about a very, very specific person who's reacting in a very, very specific way to these very specific variables. He's going to hurt another person, and I actually don't know how that would be possible to screen or outline. And they usually can only do it after the fact.
Right, and that's what's so important. And this is why we have to have these discussions in a nuanced way, because I can see this being extremely, prone to stigmatizing people with, for example, depression. And that wouldn't even be based on reality, because as you say, most people who are depressed are going to harm themselves before they harm others, right? So, but people who are kind of overly simplistic or black and white, they're just going to say, mental health issue, no gun. And here's the other thing. If we make a mental disorder, mental health issue, mental condition, an exclusionary criterion. So if you have these conditions, you cannot get a gun. Well, guess what? Many people are not going to get help that they need. That's the flip side of that. And absolutely. So it's not because we're being stigmatized. They're worried about not being able to get their damn guns or having their guns taken away. Let's just throw this out again. Let people contact you. I'm such a non-entity. Nobody knows where to find me. So they're not going to come after me. They're coming after you. And for some reason, somehow, in the last few months, I always work this into my discussions, and let people make the inferences they want, because I've got very thick skin. So I'll tell you right now, for anyone who makes the wrong inference, you're a fool. But here we go. When we talk about risk and we talk about trying to prevent harm to others and taking measures that might in fact then have the opposite effect. So once again, if we say that not allowing people with, let's say, depression or mental health issues to get guns, well, then we're preventing them from actually getting the help that they need, and then they're more likely to maybe act out on the pain or whatever they're going through, and it's not like they're not going to find the guns illegally. Well, what about then? And again, I'm not trying to shift the topic of conversation over here, but just to help people really understand this, what about people with pedophilia? It's the same idea, where it's like, wait a second, if someone says they're a pedophile, we should lock them up. But the fact is, if that's the case, well, then no pedophiles are ever going to come forward and say, I have this terrible condition, I don't want to hurt people, please get me help. And then people's emotions take over, and they say, but pedophiles don't want help. They're all monsters, they're all child sex offenders, we should just castrate them or murder them or lock them up for life. But that's not reality, that's not what the science says. And so I'm using pedophile for shock value, not for simple. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to be prurient. I'm using it to kind of shake people up and say, look, this is one example, and the parallels are very similar. We cannot let our emotions, we cannot let our schemata get triggered so that we react in ways that might feel right, but they just don't jibe with reality. And whether it's pedophilia, depression, psychopathy, mass shootings, or anything else like that, we need to look at what the facts are, not what we think they are. And people need to understand that, because ignorance leads to stigma. Stigma leads to more harm, And it's not just harming the people that you think deserve it, it's harming the people around them, because no person is an island. We all live among other people. So we need to have a better understanding of all these phenomena so that we can make good decisions, or the best possible decisions that are going to benefit the most people. And those decisions are never made through emotions. They have to be done through fact and evidence.
Absolutely. With the DSM, it seems like people aren't too fast if a serial killer's caught. It doesn't seem like people are too fast to straight away say, well, you know, they were crazy, or they're a psychopath, or have a mental health issue. It seems to be very specifically mass shooters which people get quite upset about, the idea of let's throw the book at them. Do you feel like there's a good reason for that? And also, do you feel like there's an opportunity to form a DSM criterion diagnosis around very specifically mass shooters?
A tricky question, because the base rates are quite low. That's what people have to understand. Yes, they make the news, but what percentage of the population would really fall into the category, and are they different from other types of psychopaths or depressed people or whatever else? I'm not quite sure. As an academic exercise, sure. Try to see if we can distinguish them. Would there be much utility? I'm not sure. Because are we then going to try to see if there are any predictable patterns? You know, so are we trying to look for predictive validity? Are we trying to see whether this would either mitigate or increase penalties for them and so on? I'm not quite sure. Okay. I think the reason people have this reaction, this antipathy, or just lack of any empathy for them, is they really are committing one of the closest things to evil that we can imagine. And what really scares people the most, and I think people really need to understand this is why people are not going to be able to make reasoned decisions, and it's totally rational to feel this way. When you think of mass shootings, they are random in many ways. That means that I can be the best person in the planet, yet still, my life can be snuffed out in a second. And we are the only animals who know of our death. We understand, we have a full concept of what death is, that our life is finite. And there's this whole terror management theory. And by the way, if anyone wants to look it up, most of the research behind terror management theory is garbage. It's horribly done. They do these studies and they make these wild inferences, ignoring Occam's razor. So they're saying, well, hey, A, B, and C, this is why it's happening. This is why D is happening. They add G, H, 3, pi, and all these other things to show. You see, terror management theory. So the research might be bogus, but the theory itself makes sense. And that's the idea that because we are the only creatures who understand that life is finite, if we think about it, that's really depressing. We're not here forever. When we're gone, we're gone. So we spend so much of our unconscious or our psychic energy trying to block out this realization that we've only got a few years left. And if you think about the grand scheme of things, it's a heartbeat.
What about the existential crisis of death and why people choose to get really upset about mass shooters?
So the mass shooters, their actions put it right in our face.
Yeah, it was very complicated, and I'm going to do another one with Lee Meller as well, from his perspective on the same topic. So it'd be good to see what comes out of both of them.
Yeah, that would have been great. I was going to say earlier that I'd love to hear his perspective, because he's got far more knowledge of the actual monsters, the serial killers. I've worked with a few, but he's done much more extensive readings and working with them and writing about them. So yeah, I'd love to hear what he has to say about these things, and it would be one day we should all be together, because then, right then and there, if he has, either if he has something to contradict what I say, or has another layer of nuance to add to it, or another factor I had to consider, or can put it together in a better way, I'd love to hear it, because that's what it's all about, learning.
Yeah, I agree. I think that would be really great, and I'm going to try and devise a way to edit it all together so that he actually gets a chance, perhaps, to respond to some of the things that you and I have said. But then I can release it as one kind of general podcast, or maybe two parts of a podcast.
Right. That'd be very cool, yes.
Yeah. So I'll sort that out and kind of let you know how I'm going about doing that.